I'm going to go ahead and get started. Welcome, everyone. I wanted to welcome you all to MomsFightingAutism.com tonight. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I have a 14-year-old son with autism, and I've been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of four. I've served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistant technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There's two ways to participate in tonight's webinar. You can log into momsfightingautism.com, and once you're there, you'll see a blue box that says register for this webinar, and it's completely free, so go ahead and click the box. And once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen. There you can click listen in and hear the discussion via the internet. Click ask a question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. You can also listen by phone by calling 949-333-4806 and enter conference ID 168978#. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry about background noise. We can't hear you. Later in our webinar, I'll let telephone listeners know how they can ask a question live directly to our presenter if they wish. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click slides to view the slideshow. It takes about 19 seconds or so to connect, so be patient. It will connect. Once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Be sure to mute your computer if you're listening by phone so you don't get an echo. Okay, let me go ahead and introduce our speaker tonight. We have Marla Root. Marla is the Director of Community Affairs and Advocacy with Step by Step Academy in Worthington, Ohio. She has worked with hundreds of individuals and families throughout the state, including myself. She is the 2010 Advocate of the Year recipient awarded by the Governor's Council for People with Disabilities. She has provided presentations for many organizations, such as the Ohio Coalition for the Education of Children with Disabilities, Franklin County Children's Services, Autism Society Chapters, OCALI, which is the Ohio Coalition for Autism and Low Incidence, Milestones, State Support Teams, and the Ohio Center for the Deafblind Education. Marla has been advocating for funding and services since 1998, when her son was diagnosed with autism. Marla is currently a board member for the Autism Society of Ohio, the Ohio Association of Behavior Analysis and Food for Good Thought. She is a member of the Ohio Association of Behavior Analysis. Marla has a Bachelor of Science Finance degree from Franklin University. Welcome, Marla.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you, Nancy. What a fantastic introduction. Thank you. Hello, everybody. Nancy kind of told you a little bit about me, and I want to tell you a little bit more as well because I think it's really important that you understand the perspective I've come from and things I've done and how they've shaped my learning, things that I have learned and how I share them with parents. As you can see on your screen there, I do work for Step by Step Academy. We are a center for children with autism. We serve children, adults, and adolescents. And right here, my experience with disabilities. So this is my son. He's actually 15 now. He's a large gentleman. He is about 6'7", and about 240 pounds, so he's a big guy. He is severely impacted by autism and an intellectual disability. And so that's been my impact, right? So that's my passion, just like probably for many of you and Nancy. So it's important to know that I live in it, I breathe it, and I help advocate. So, but I'm also a provider of services. So because I work at Step by Step Academy, I also understand how to be a service provider to individuals with autism and really with disabilities. So that gives me an interesting perspective because I understand some of the Medicaid rules and some of the funding, how to bill things, and that helps me help families to access services. And then as Nancy said there, that, you know, I do a lot of advocating and thank goodness Step by Step, definitely part of our mission is if we have the knowledge, we need to get the knowledge out to people. So I've been very, very lucky that Step by Step has hired me full time to do advocacy work, community affairs, and advancing services, funding, abilities, anything that can help an individual with autism. So I've got a couple of slides here just to let you know a little bit about what Step by Step does. Again, we're located in Columbus, Ohio. We are an intensive behavioral intervention treatment facility and using applied behavior analysis. It's a fantastic organization. We carry many certifications. Our big one is a national certification called CARF. It's a very big deal accreditation that allows us to use behavioral health care and do some of the things we do. So that's a little bit about us. But I think what, you know, really we all want to know how to access services and access funding. And when I was thinking about how to talk tonight, I really got thinking about something I think parents may not know how to a tool to use to drive finding funding and services. And so what I want to talk about is advocating with knowledge, where you go out and you know terms, you know how to get services that you feel your child needs. And we all know that when we've had, either if you're a family member, if you're a professional, or you're you have a friend with a child with autism, there's signs of autism that we all need to know. So this I pulled right off First Signs website of autism. Deficits are usually in core areas such as social skills, communication, and behaviors and other interests. And then I kind of list them here. So as we are trying to make our physicians more aware of these signs so they can help families at an earlier age. We know early detection of any kind of disability or even a medical concern for a child is very important to diagnose as early as we can. So I always like to do whatever event I am is talk about what are those first signs of autism. I am very excited that the Ohio State University here is starting to create a curriculum for physicians in training, so they're in medical school, where they are going to get access and specific curriculum for people with disabilities, because believe it or not, that doesn't really exist throughout the United States right now. So I'm very excited about that, but you know, it's important that our the individuals with autism have access to good medical care, but also that those physicians know what is autism and so forth. So, you know, we talk about lack of appropriate eye gaze, lack of warm and joyful expressions, sharing interest and enjoyment, responding to their name when their name is called, lack of response to gestures, nonverbal communication, where they lack the coordination of that. Maybe they have echolalia, where they speak, they repeat, you know, maybe a movie line, or they repeat a word, or they're sing-songy. Repetitive behaviors, maybe they're rocking. My son is unfortunately, he does a lot of visual stemming. So he would put his fingers in front of his eyes, or he will take a straw and kind of put that in front of his eyes. So that's a repetitive behavior that he does. And repetitive movements or posturing of the body. So we know a lot of kids, they walk on their toes, they walk in circles, they rock. So it's always good to know, you know, what are those signs of autism? And it's always important to share as we are out there advocating and making everybody aware. Assessments of needs. So as we, you know, as we may have concerns about a child or an individual, we need to go get some assessments done. And what I want to drive with parents is when you get good assessments, you now have tools to take somewhere to get treatment. And so the better the assessment, the better your treatment recommendations you could have, and you can go out and get treatment. So it's important to know there are medical assessments and there are educational assessments, and they are two different things. So I get a lot of people who say, well, my school district assessed him, which is great, and that needs to be done to get services in education. But if you want to get services in the medical field, behavioral health care field, you also need to get a medical assessment, okay? So when we're talking about a medical assessment tool, we're talking about psychologists or professionals that are using the most recent state-of-the-art assessment tools for autism. That's very important. And then the purpose of the evaluation is to go and get medical behavioral treatment for the individual. And these are the areas that we list here, these seven areas that are very important to get the testing. I talk a lot about coming up scope of practice. So you would want to go to a psychologist who's licensed in your area, but who also maybe does a lot of assessments and diagnoses for individuals with autism. You wouldn't want to go to a professional who doesn't serve a lot of individuals with autism. You want to know somebody who is very knowledgeable, knows what those state-of-the-art testing tools are, and they've been they've been trained well to do the testing tool. So that's always important because, again, the better the testing tools are, the better the treatment and access to treatment and the things you can take that report and go advocate for. One of the things I should tell you guys, and what you probably could tell, is I'm not a clinical person, but I've learned a lot through the clinical. I work with board-certified behavior analysts. We have psychologists. We have licensed independent social workers. So a lot of these things I pick up from them and understand, you know, these are licensed individuals or they carry a certification. So, you know, there's ethical practices they have to follow. So you learn a lot about how to make appropriate reports that meet the individual's needs and so forth. Now, talking about the educational assessment, this is needed to see if the child qualifies for special education. So in Ohio, we do a multi-factored evaluation that looks at many areas of the child. Now, and then what happens is they come up with a report, and then that's when they determine, does the child need special education? Do they qualify? And then what kind of instruction is appropriate for that student? Because remember, an IEP, which is your individual education plan, remember IEP, the I is the first letter there, it's individualized. And so it's very important. So sometimes I hear parents say, hey, you know, I really want my son to have speech therapy. Let's use that as an example. And they've asked that for that, and the school's not giving it to them. So what I always tell the parent, go back to your education evaluation, the assessment, and what did it say? Does it say your child? Was your child assessed for speech? And communication, they would probably be under communication. And what did it say about that? Maybe it makes a statement in there and says, hey, the child really struggles being able to communicate his feelings and maybe his wants and needs. He doesn't really have functional communication. Oh, well, then yes, you could see why the parent would want speech therapy for the child. So again, it's using these the results of these assessments to drive going out and getting appropriate services for your child, and especially professionals, right? So if you have an advocate working with you or maybe you're bringing your psychologist to the school, they need to be bringing these assessments and because that's very important. So you can see here the list of areas under the educational assessments that that can be looked at. The educational assessment happens every 3 years, at least it does in Ohio, and I think that would be throughout the United States. And so usually if a child is identified around the age of three, that would be the first multi-factored educational assessment at that time. And then it would go every 3 years after. Back to the medical assessment, what we're trying to do at Step by Step Academy is really to try to do a psychological evaluation every 12 months if we can. It's amazing that what you got to realize is these assessments and these evaluations are giving you baseline data, right? So it's giving you information to say at this point of time, this is where this child or individual is. And then if you do those testing another year or 18 months or 24 months later, where have they progressed? How do we know our kids are progressing? What rate are they progressing? We have to have these tools to help us tell us that. And so you can see why it's very important to go to somebody who, you know, has been trained well and does this quite often. They understand the assessment tools. They're very good at doing it. So these assessments help us as parents and professionals to go get help for the individuals we're assessing. After you've done an assessment, obviously our webinar tonight is about, you know, autism. It's trying to, you know, making sure you understand the diagnoses. Autism is an umbrella term for the autism spectrum disorders or the pervasive developmental disorders. So autism is again, it's an umbrella term. So when we hear the phrase autism spectrum disorder, you know, that's where it's a range of complex neurodevelopmental disorders characterized by social impairments, communication difficulties, restrictive, repetitive, and stereotypic patterns of behavior, all those things we talked about on those first signs. But what some people don't know, and this is, again, another thing as we're being good advocates and parents and professionals, is there are five other diagnoses that make up the autism spectrum disorders. Mainly people think of autistic disorder, or they may have heard of Asperger's syndrome, but they may not know of the other three listed there. So that's another thing we can do to inform people that the, you know, Rett syndrome, the PDD-NOS, these are part of the umbrella of autism, specifically the autism spectrum disorders. So that's really important for parents to know. The other thing that's very important for parents to know, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit more, is the idea that autism is a complex. I mean, it says that in its definition. It's a complex neurodevelopmental disorder. And autism is an Axis I mental health diagnosis. So in the DSM-IV, which is the American Psychiatric Association published manual on diagnoses, okay, because a diagnosis has a number with it, which autism is 299.0, and 299.0 is autistic disorder. So many people don't realize that it really is a mental health disorder. And that is it is a spectrum, right? We have individuals who are what we used to say are lower functioning, but, you know, and higher functioning. And in the world, we're trying to not really use low and high functioning anymore. I tend to use, you know, well, this child is, you know, greatly impacted, or this child is, you know, just a little impacted, and talk about more about that child specifically. But it is a spectrum, and when you look at an individual with autism, they can have co-occurring diagnoses as well. My son happens to have the intellectual disability. So remember, it used to be called mental retardation, and it still is, but the political term now, and to be correct, is intellectual disability. And many children and individuals with autism may have obsessive compulsive disorder. They may have anxiety disorder. It's interesting, and it's good to know that, you know, just not people don't always just have the autism diagnosis. There can be co-occurring diagnoses, and again, with good proper treatment and assessments of those, you can go get services for those. But it's interesting because Stephen Shore, who is an individual impacted with autism and Asperger's syndrome, I think it is, who does fantastic job going out and advocating, he said, when you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And isn't that the truth? I know at our center here in Columbus, we have 120 kids on our campus, but we probably serve about 160, 170 kids, but everybody is different, and that's why it's important to have assessments done and get these reports so they can be individualized so we can go get the proper treatment they need. So,
Marla, I did one of these webinars with Dr. Shore a couple months ago, and he said he did not like the phrase, you know, high functioning, low functioning. Mm-hmm. I had a really difficult time doing the rest of that webinar because that is just so ingrained in our vocabulary.
It is.
I was really struggling for the right words.
it really is. And, you know, but it's definitely moving in the right direction. And, you know, I don't know what the right thing is to say, but, you know, I tend to say, you know, hey, this is a child who's very impacted by the autism disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in the middle of that change, I think. And it's a good point you bring up, because the other big thing that we try to say is, I have a son with autism. We always want to use that people first language. Yeah, people first language. You know, I know an individual with autism, or my nephew has autism. So, and the changeover from mental retardation to intellectual disability. So we're seeing a lot more of that, and which is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Okay, so we've talked about knowing the signs of autism. We've talked about, you know, getting proper assessments through the medical and through the educational fields. We talked about, you know, understanding the diagnosis, and that individuals that carry an autism spectrum disorder are a spectrum, and everyone's different, and their needs are different, co-occurring disorders. And so we need to go out and take that report and that information and get proper treatment recommendations. So being very clear in these reports is important. So one of the things we do at Step by Step Academy, and our psychologist, Dr. Wagner, is just fantastic. You know, when we give a parent a psychological report, it's very clear. All the testing results are in that report, and then our recommendations are clearly there. So we may say, this child has an area of need of behavioral intervention because this child tends to bite his wrist. He bites his wrist, it's been reported by mom, and it was observed by the psychologist 6 to 7, 8 times a day, let's say. So we need these reports to be a very good picture of our child. It needs to paint a good picture of our child. So when you go into a service provider and you hand them these reports, they're reading them, and they're trying to figure out, can we serve this child in the manner they need to be served? I think, this is a hard thing, because we have school districts. We have, in Ohio, we have a scholarship program. And so you can take your child out of public school and take it to a private, scholarship provider. And I think sometimes, people think they can serve, I serve individuals with autism. That's a very broad blanket statement. And so I think, when you go somewhere and you're looking seriously at a placement, you need to sit down with them, maybe go over the psychological assessment. Did you read this about my son? How can you handle this problem behavior of him biting his wrist? So you want to use these tools to get the right service your child needs. Plus, you wouldn't want a service provider saying, oh, yeah, just bring him over, we'll be able to serve him either, okay? They need to prepare. They need to plan, especially if this is an individual, you know, more impacted on the spectrum. So painting a very clear picture of the child is so important. And again, you know, stating the results of each testing. We do, unfortunately, see sometimes psychological evaluations come into our center, and they are so vague, we cannot get a picture, especially if mom and dad are telling us something, and then we're looking at the psychological report, and this is another reason to get those psychological reports done more often than just maybe once or every 3 or 4 years. Getting them more often is better. What else we have here? We have treatment goals and behavior support plans need to be created around the assessment recommendations. So if a child who is not impacted greatly and has many communication skills, and maybe just needs some social skill work, what would be the recommendation? The psychologist may say, hey, this child needs some social skill classes, he needs to be able to practice social skills in a safe environment, and then once he feels comfortable, try to do those amongst his peers. I mean, you know, that's what you're looking for when you go see a psychologist. You're looking for their treatment recommendations, not just the diagnosis. What is your treatment recommendations? My son Eli is nonverbal. And he has some words, but he has an augmentative communication device. So I would think a psychologist who would be observing my son would say, you know, Eli is nonverbal and he needs a functional communication system, and hence he needs to use PECS, which is the picture exchange system, or he needs an augmentative device. And hence he needs to go get a speech therapy evaluation to do that. So that's why it is so important. Sometimes parents say, well, I want ABA for my child. Well, yeah, okay, but, you know, has a psychologist seen him or somebody, have they seen him and diagnosed him? And, you know, do they need intensive behavioral intervention? Do they need some behavioral intervention? You know, what is needed there? And I think that's important. And so this whole process that I'm really talking about here is the golden thread. So I want to pop back. Knowing something's going on, so knowing the signs, getting an assessment, a proper assessment with proper state-of-the-art tools, understanding the diagnosis, taking that diagnosis and the treatment recommendations and going to find services, and then how do we fund those services? And then how do we get the outcome, the treatment outcomes we want? And this is what you call the golden thread. And so that's what, you know, that's what this is all really moving towards as our discussion tonight.
Marla, is there a certain test that you would recommend or that you think should be done, a certain assessment?
I probably, I should have thought about having those available. I used to know all these. I think I have these on my computer, so let me pop and see if I can find those, and then we can talk about them in a little bit.
I'm just curious because I think other people are going to be wanting to ask for a specific, you know, evaluation or...
Yeah, absolutely. I think I can find that, and that's a great question. So because there really are certain testing that you want to make sure are done. So we will pop over and we'll get that. That's for sure.
All right.
Okay. So some of the things that I want parents to understand is, you know, autism is a multi-system needs diagnosis. And what we mean by that is it's a spectrum. And a large number of individuals diagnosed with autism need a combination of medical care, right, a psychiatrist, behavioral health care, psychologist, maybe a behavior analyst. They need funding from many state agencies, such as here in Ohio, we have a Department of Mental Health, a Department of Developmental Disabilities, a Department of Health. You know, that's what we mean by needing services and funding through many agencies. They need in-home and community services, right? Sometimes us parents need a break, and we need to be able to have somebody come in our home that our loved ones can be safe with, and they're trained, and they know about autism. They need educational services, counseling, case management, crisis intervention, short and long-term residential. These are multi-system children and individuals needing services. So they're just, and remember going back to that diagnosis that, you know, autism is a complex neurodevelopmental disability. So, I always want parents to know that in your area, if you're being directed to, you know, one area of a funding stream, in your state, you need to be advocating for the services, not really the funding. You know, drive it that way. Hey, my psychologist has recommended intensive behavioral intervention, and I hear there's a mental health service to do that. How do I get that service? Okay? So it's always important because you got to drive the need, will drive the funding. We talk about there in Ohio, and I would assume this happens through many states, and they sometimes you hear the word cluster funding, and that's where many different agencies or departments that have some of the state Medicaid funding or whatever they have come together to support an individual's needs. I will tell you that we've been going through a very behavioral difficult time with my son, and I've been working with a cluster group. So I've actually been working with children's services in my state. I've been working with mental health. I've been working with the Department of Developmental Disabilities. So sometimes a level of need of an individual would need more of a cluster funding and advocacy group. One of the things we hear parents say a lot is, I need ABA therapy. But ABA therapy is not a covered Medicaid service or insurance-funded service. And so what I'd like to get parents to, even though I love bringing awareness to what ABA is, when we talk to professionals in the medical field and things like that, we need to be saying intensive behavioral treatment, intensive behavioral intervention. That is something the people in the medical field can grab onto and they understand what you're talking about. Not everybody. So you could say, hey, my child is in need of intensive behavioral intervention, and I'm aware that applied behavior analysis is extremely effective, you know, for individuals with autism. So we want to, and as we start getting more and more states getting autism insurance reform and getting our health insurance companies to pay for treatment, they're actually paying for intensive behavioral intervention. They're not just paying for applied behavior analysis. Because remember, behavioral analysis is the science of studying behavior, right? And there's principles and so forth around that. The other thing to know around terminology is the level of care, level of need. What, especially for individuals on the spectrum who are more impacted by the diagnosis, level of care and level of need is very important. Again, it's kind of a medical term. It's a little more of a professional term, but it really helps bring the seriousness maybe to a situation. So with my son, when, you know, I just felt like, you know, he is having some, you know, major problem aggressive behaviors, this is becoming beyond my ability to keep him safe in my home or whatever. Really what I was saying, his level of care is beyond my ability, or it's beyond the ability of you know, like the people I have that come in the home and work with him. So you know, it's really understanding that people with autism have a level of care, you know, to them. And, you know, and when you state it in those terms, I think people start, oh, you're saying, you know, you're saying you have your child's level of care is moving beyond your ability in what specific manner. And it can start a very good conversation. Scope of practice we talked about earlier, you know, we need to look for professionals in our communities that have specialized training in autism spectrum disorders and who serve individuals in their everyday practice. And I think that's so important for families. You're going to walk away with a better, if you go to a psychologist who is well trained in the state-of-the-art tools, then that's what you're looking for, okay? And you could always ask, hey, have you attended a training recently about autism assessment tools? You know, things like that. But those are the people that you're looking for, because you would be surprised how many psychologists, you know, it's got to be, behavior has to be in the scope of practice. So if you have an individual who's greatly impacted and maybe has a lot of problem behaviors, you would want to go to a psychologist who has a good understanding of behaviors. Right? So those are the things you're looking for. If you're wanting a behavior consultant to come in your home, you want that person to have knowledge and schooling and hopefully maybe a certification around behavior analysis. So that's what we're talking about. It, you know, is serving my child in your scope of practice? Do you serve these people on a daily basis? So we talked about knowing the signs, getting a proper assessment and diagnostic report to go get, to provide us treatment recommendations, and now the funding piece. So funding is complex, and it's a maze, and I've just kind of listed some of the fundings here that I know are here in Ohio, and that I, you know, hear talked about in other states too. you know, we, many, many families who maybe are sitting on long waiting lists or can't qualify for Medicaid are doing a lot of private pay. Maybe they're trying to get donations from advocacy groups or grants, something to help support them. I know there's usually some grants available for summer services because that's such a hard time for families when school is out. You know, what do we do with our family member? For one, we don't want them to lose skills they've learned, but where can they go? And sometimes those camps and summer services are not cheap. health insurance plans. Some health insurance plans may pay for some services you're looking for your child. Educational funding. Obviously, when your child comes in through the education and through schools, if they qualify for special education, then they get additional funding than what a typical child at the school would get. Ohio, I think Florida, now have scholarship programs where you can now pull your child from that public school and place in a private organization. If you want to learn more, the Ohio scholarship program is called the Autism Scholarship Program, and it's on our Ohio Department of Education website. And it's also, we have a new scholarship program that just came out, the John Peterson scholarship program, which will actually give any child with a disability could access it. It is capped on the number of slots, but you would take, you know, whatever that school funding is that they're receiving, and you take that with your child, depending on their category. And then you would take that funding to go access services outside the school district. Medicaid card, or what we would call fee-for-service Medicaid, individuals who get a paper Medicaid card or maybe a hard card when they're on a managed care program, those are ways to go out and access services, so that's a funding stream. We have home and community-based service Medicaid waivers that are just wonderful programs. We're going to talk about what a waiver is here in a little bit. The cluster funding that I talked about, that when the level of care is intense for an individual, how can multiple state agencies come together and fund what the individual needs? State dollars collected. In Ohio, we have 88 counties, so we have all these local levies. So what other funding, you know, are brought in through property tax or state taxes or sales tax? And then we have Social Security, where some individuals can qualify on Social Security based on their disability and their family income, and then how that, you know, income can be used to not only support the individual but also to access treatment. So we talked about it being a funding maze, and it really is. Each state's funding terminology is different. You know, so I used to live in Arizona, and I had a large Medicaid waiver in Arizona that provided a lot of services in my home. And with that Medicaid waiver, I got a Medicaid card. When my husband and I decided to move back to our home state of Ohio when our son was 7, we could not transfer that waiver. So we had to come back to the state of Ohio and get put back on a wait list. So, you know, every state is different, and Medicaid, you know, won't travel outside your state line. There is a time it will travel outside your state line if your child or individual needs a service that cannot be found in that state. Your child can go to that other state and get the service, and Ohio Medicaid hopefully could travel with them to pay for the service. So if your child was looking, so I live in Ohio, if I was to send my son to Florida to a provider there of services, I would have to get that provider to become an Ohio Medicaid provider, and then it could transfer with him. But normally, if you're just moving, a permanent move, you're going to have to requalify for Medicaid or requalify for a Medicaid waiver in that new state. The names of the state agencies that fund services for people with autism are all different. They are all different. And Sometimes, like in Ohio, we have four different departments. Sometimes those are all in one department in one state. And this makes it very difficult for families when families need to make a permanent move to another state. How do you, you know, you get a lot of anxiety around that move because you don't understand what's going to be available there for your loved one. And I'll tell you, that's when you really need to contact like grassroots advocacy groups, like the Autism Society, and get in with a parent group there, because parents have a lot of knowledge, and that's a great way to do that. And then autism may fall under one agency in one state and then another.
Uh-huh? Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt, but your phone seems to be cutting out. Is the battery dying?
No, I'm on a hardwired phone. Can you hear me now?
It's just making a really blurby noise. I don't understand.
Huh, that's real. Okay, let me
oh,
transfer.
Wait. It seems to be better.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Continue.
Okay, perfect. So autism can fall under different agencies in different states. Here in Ohio, autism, mainly the lead agency is the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities, where in Pennsylvania, I think you guys have a department there, like Department of Human Services, and it's all under one. So every state is different, and that makes it very difficult. The names of some Medicaid waivers can be different between states. Some states have the educational scholarship programs, as we mentioned, that you can take from the school and go to the community to purchase services. And then some states have autism insurance reform. I think it's 27 states, if I'm saying that correctly, that, you know, you now, you know, if you're on a proper employer health plan, have them actually provide some behavioral intervention support and speech therapy and some of these things that your child needs. So as you can tell, that this makes it really, really difficult, and hence why it's so important to whatever community you live in that you're accessing advocacy groups there, because that is huge for families. So my next slide is very busy, and hopefully you can see it okay, but I just kind of wanted, this is a slide, I do a lot of speeches specifically for Ohio, trying to advocate for families to learn how to access funding and services, and where funding and services even exist from. And so this is my slide, so we're just going to talk about this in general terms, but there at the top where it says CMS, CMS is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and they're the federal agency who has the Medicaid and the Medicaid waiver programs. And a state actually has to ask to be in the Medicaid program. So that program's come, you know, once that's all done and the contract's done, you know, it comes to the governor, and then the governor will give a lead, like a single state Medicaid agency at that time. So in Ohio, ours is called the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. But we also have a couple other departments that provide Medicaid services as well. And those departments all have an interagency contract with the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. So you have the Ohio Department of Health, the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities, the Ohio Department of Mental Health, and the Ohio Department of Education. And so you can see, if you can see how we talked about earlier, how people with autism are multi-system needs. You know, if you have a child who's 21 and under, well, yeah, they need a Ohio Department of Education services. Autism is a mental health disorder, and I know I can access psychological assessments and medication management from the Ohio Department of Mental Health providers. Oh, I do need a Medicaid waiver. My individual needs help when they're in the home. I need respite care, and I need help to support them in the home. Well, then here in Ohio, we would go over to the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities, because that would be where the appropriate Medicaid waiver would be for people with autism. And then, of course, zero to the age of three, you know, when they're very young, then they get a lot of services over the Ohio Department of Health. So no matter what state you are in, you know, your kid is going to be a multi-system. It's just how many systems are there. And I'll tell you, what we're finding in our state that's very, very exciting now is all these systems are now talking to each other. And I'm sure a lot of this is the advancement of the internet and exchange of information and computers and everything, because it used to be they were all their individual silos. And so I always found it very frustrating when the parent would say, well, I was sent to the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities, but my son really needs counseling, and I'd love to, for him to get in some group and maybe some individual counseling. And I would say, wow, how come somebody didn't refer you to the Ohio Department of Mental Health who offers counseling? So as you can see, it, you know, the good thing is these silos are coming down, and here we're seeing these interagencies speaking to each other. And I hear from advocates, you know, nationwide that this is starting to happen everywhere else too. I don't think we're the leader in it here in Ohio, but it's very exciting for multi-system diagnoses like autism. So that's very exciting. The other thing that this slide depicts is, I don't know about you guys, but there's so much paperwork around having an individual with a disability. I have an IEP at my school, which is an individual education plan. I have an ISP at my county board of developmental disabilities for my child's waiver, and an ISP is an individual support plan. If I'm getting services from the Ohio Department of Health, I would have an IFSP, which is an individual family service plan. So just know that, you know, whenever you're getting a Medicaid service, and really anytime you're getting a health insurance funded insurance, there's a treatment plan, and that's these individual plans. And these treatment plans are what drives the service. It drives what your psychologist's treatment recommendations were. And so it's just important to know, when you access funding from an agency, there's going to be a treatment plan that comes with that. How's the money going to be used? What services do they need? And who said the individual needs the need? Or what psychologist recommended that treatment, I should say. So it's a very busy slide, but, you know, every state would have a slide that looks similar to that. Every state would be different. And that is what is very, very hard for families to navigate the system. What services can a person provide? What happens is a lot of time we get put on wait list, and we're sitting on the wait list. And sometimes we're not told that, hey, while you're sitting on the Medicaid waiver wait list, go try to qualify for Medicaid. Go try to look for these other things. So what this slide is showing us is really what are the Medicaid mandated services. So these are all services that if you have a Medicaid card and you have a professional who has given you treatment recommendations, you should be able to go purchase these treatments. And so because they're mandated, these are services that are not going to be cut because they're federally mandated. So one of the ones that I just want to point out to you is the health check. That is EPSDT there. It's the third line down. This is an extremely important federal mandate that protects children. And it protects anybody 21 and younger. It's the early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment services to children 21 and younger. This is a protection. And basically it says, if your psychologist has given a treatment recommendation and you cannot access that treatment for whatever reason, that EPSDT protects that individual by saying, but they have a medical doctor who says they need a treatment. We need to find and create this treatment for them. And so it's an extremely protective services. I always like to point that out. One thing you don't see on the mandated list, you don't see home and community-based waivers, which is what the autism population uses a lot of. You don't see speech therapy, occupational therapy here. And that, you know, that's very scary. So what that tells us is those services are found under the optional Medicaid services. These are services that can be cut. And we know right now in this budget crisis that they've been talking about entitlement programs and cutting them, and optional services for Medicaid would fall under there. But it's very concerning because you see dental services here. You see home and community-based waivers could be cut, independent psychological services for children. You see occupational physical therapy. So there are, and speech therapy, so, you know, really important services that are considered to be optional that can be cut. But we just have to pray that, you know, we hang in there and not be impacted by that. So what is a waiver? A waiver is a set plan of services. And it's like a menu. You've been given a waiver. Here's your menu of services. What would you like? And depending on how much the waiver is, you pick your services based on your individual with the disability's needs. So remember, a state's waiver gets approved through CMS, the Center of Medicaid and Medicare Services, and that waiver will get approved, and that's what will be offered to you. And in Ohio, we have a small waiver called the Level 1 waiver. It's $5,000 a year. However, when you read and you read the handbook, you actually get $8,000 of emergency care, $3,000 of specialized equipment, and you get a Medicaid card. And then we also have a waiver called the Individual Options Waiver, which is an extremely large waiver. And that waiver provides a large array of services. And guess what happens on that waiver? Your individual with a disability will be assessed, just like we talked about medical assessments and just like we talked about educational assessments. They will be assessed, and needs and treatment recommendations will be made, and then they'll determine a funding level to go with that waiver. So remember, a waiver is a state plan of services, and so those services then you could go purchase at that time. I will let you know that my son has the individual options waiver in Ohio, which is the larger waiver. My son has intensive behavioral needs. My waiver funding is set at $36,000 a year. And my son needs some two-on-one at some point. And so that's to give you just an example of how that works. You do have to meet a level of care through an assessment process, and then a funding range would be set. One thing that you need to know about Medicaid waivers, when you get a Medicaid waiver for your loved one, the good thing is they don't look at the family income. The waiver, the first thing you're waiving is your right to a more institutionalized care. You're saying that you're going to accept this waiver that's going to provide you in-home community-based services, and you waive the institutional care. But the other thing it waives is the family's income, okay? So you can be beyond the level of Medicaid but still be given a Medicaid waiver because it's a waiver. But what happens is the individual with a disability cannot have more what they call resources or, you know, cash liquid assets of more than $1,500. If your loved one would accumulate more than $1,500, they would have what they call a patient liability, and they'd have to spend some of that money to get back down under the $1,500, and then the waiver would kick back in. So just be aware that that's how Medicaid waivers work, and that's why, you know, that's why a family that maybe has a larger income has a Medicaid waiver, like a family with a lower income does, because the waiver waives that institutional care, waives that family's income, but there's still the individual with a disability has to watch how much cash, liquid cash, they have, so they maintain eligible for their services. The waiver services, no matter what state you're in, no matter what the waiver is called, I've listed, I think there's 8 services here, usually contain these 8 services. They may be called different in state to state, but waivers are a way to keep individuals in our homes and in our communities and support them so they can be successful. So the first line there, respite, homemaker personal care aid. This is where you would have somebody come in your home and work with the individual with a disability. So they may come in and help the individual cook, hey, let's make dinner together. You need to learn how to cook. And then maybe they learn how to clean up after cooking. These individuals can help them do laundry. Maybe they watch TV and hang out together. And maybe they go to a doctor's appointment together. That's respite, homemaker, personal care, and personal care aid is that individualized service. Maybe the individual needs help with a lot of daily living skills. They need help getting dressed. They need help brushing their teeth. They need help, you know, taking a bath. While the service is being provided, this person, this respite care worker or homemaker personal care worker should be training or teaching the individual to do these things themselves. So it's not like they're just doing it for them. There should be a treatment plan. What does the individual need? The individual is impacted in a physical way. Maybe that individual does need to be bathed, and that's not a treatment goal. We're not trying to teach this individual to bathe himself because, unfortunately, due to physical complications, he cannot do that. But we may be teaching that individual to type on a computer, read, whatever else it is. So remember, even though it's a Medicaid waiver, again, an assessment's been done, treatment recommendations, and a plan has been put in place, and that's what these individuals are working off of whenever these, or what this is what all these waiver services are working off of. Transportation. Now, that is really a big deal for families. You know, getting our loved ones to and from doctor's appointments, school, just to go out in the community and go swimming, go out to eat. So transportation can be a waiver service. Environmental accessibility modifications. Individuals with disabilities need wheelchair ramps. They need, I don't know if you've ever seen the utensils called Dining with Dignity. They need help holding utensils, and if they just get modified a little bit, they're successful doing it. Maybe you've seen the buddy bike, which is a bike built for two, where the individual with a disability sits in the front and the parent or whoever the caregiver sits in the back, and that allows them to be able to ride a bike like everybody else. Those are environmental accessibilities. Specialized medical equipment would be, maybe they've got like a feeding tube, they need oxygen, something like that's going on that they need some sort of specialized medical equipment. Supportive and enclave employment. So as our loved ones age and they exit education, okay, so whatever age that is, we know that our loved ones can stay in an educational program until their 22nd birthday. But an individual team may decide that at the 18, you know, they want to move on to adult services, then they would exit out of education and they can maybe access waiver services to help them get supportive employment. So I would have a job coach or job shadow go with me to a job, or enclave employment where I'm an individual with a disability working maybe with 4 to 5 other individuals with disability with a couple of job coaches, and maybe we go out and as a group we do landscaping, cleaning offices, office work, whatever it is, but we do it in a group. So that's a very good service that a waiver provides. Then we have adult day and vocational services. So maybe individuals with a disability that are a little more impacted that can't take advantage of the employment, job coaching and stuff we just talked about, it provides them a day treatment program where they would go to work on vocational skill building, maybe social skill building, leisure skills. So, you know, when they exit education, if they have a waiver, is an adult day programming available. Some waivers provide nutritional support, and then some waivers provide social work and counseling support, which can be very important to the entire family, so the individual with the diagnosis, but, you know, for the family members that, you know, love and care, and we all know it's a hard job, and so, you know, getting those supports under the waiver, those are common waiver services. So remember, we talked about a waiver is a set plan of services, and these are some common set services that are built under a waiver. So I think, if we go back to, you know, what I call the golden thread, many people do, I guess, in the field, there we go, is, again, you know, knowing something's going on, we go get a proper assessment, which gives us a diagnosis, which gives us treatment recommendations. we have to go out and find funding and services to match those treatment recommendations. And then, of course, we monitor and hope for good treatment outcomes. And again, monitoring those treatment outcomes by getting new, fresher assessment and diagnostic report to show us, is the child progressing? And remember that, you know, is the model of treatment that is being provided right now working, or should we go try something else? And again, when you have baseline data through assessment, through proper assessment tools, it can be huge. So hopefully I've given a really good kind of overview, about all this. I think sometimes families struggle to get services. And I think if they go back and they say, hey, I have a medical professional saying my child needs this type of treatment for this diagnosis, and we bring that full circle, then we can go out and advocate and help. And I think that, you know, that is a huge piece for families to be able to do. So, Nancy, I think that's my slides. I know I'm going to try to look up the testing materials because I know I have them.
Okay. Do you have a slide you could put up that has your contact information?
Oh.
Someone has a question for you.
I do. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I didn't download it to you, though.
Okay.
So what do I...
You could just tell us.
Okay. True. Good point. Well, the easy thing is this, actually. Let's go back up. If you go out and you check out Step by Step Academy, you will find me on there. So if you go under Advocacy, Community Affairs, you will see me on there. And my contact is everybody can email me and call me up there. I have some testimonials on there that would be interesting for people to read, and things that I've done to testify in the Senate and so forth for services. So, but yeah, that's probably the best way to get me is just drive it through the website.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay, so as far as evaluations go, you're looking those up.
Mm-hmm.
And while you do that, I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to let those that are calling on their phones to know that if they press *2 and raise their hand, they don't literally have to raise their hand, but if they press *2, it alerts me that they have a question, and I can click on them and they can ask the question live. So if you have a question for Marla you'd like to ask and you're calling on your phone, go ahead and press *2, and I will see your hand raised. In the meantime, we had a question that came in from Elizabeth in San Diego. She asks, this may be an irrational fear, but I'm concerned that I will lose control over my son's affairs if I sign him up for Medicare or Medicaid. What are your thoughts about that?
That's a fantastic question. You know, when you... Any time that you go to get treatment or you're accessing public funding like that, you do it as a team. And so you meet as a team. So you would be there. You can bring anybody you want. Remember, individuals with disabilities have rights. They are, and you know, not only do they have, you know, human rights, they have rights to bring people to help advocate with you. And so sometimes I tell parents, you know, if you're feeling overwhelmed or, you know, bring somebody with you. They don't have to know a lot, but just a little bit, and somebody familiar in the room helps. But, yeah, you do, but individual with a disability has rights, and you as the parent who's the guardian has rights. And so what's amazing now, even through Children's Services, Protective Children's Services, where I know and I work with many families whose children are placed into a residential placement. So, you know, the child's level of need has gone beyond that family's ability to serve them, and they get placed somewhere. you do no longer, at least no longer in Ohio, and I think this is really going on throughout the nation, you don't have to give up custody for that child anymore. And so there are ways, you're seeing more and more ways for families to stay in control of individuals with disabilities than you've ever seen before. And, you know, the first place I really heard somebody say, oh, they're not letting somebody access something who has a disability, that's a human rights issue. And that was the ARC. So if you look up ARC of the United States, that organization is huge on, you know, human rights for individuals with individuals or with disabilities. So what you need to know is Medicaid, Medicare doesn't have anything to do with your guardianship of your child. They are not going to come in and take your child. Now, I will tell you, though, that the more services you have in your home and the more people you have come in your home, and, you know, those are more people that have eyes on what's going on in the home. And sometimes you could get somebody who may not have a good knowledge of autism, who maybe may feel something weird, I don't know, but that could go tell somebody else that maybe, you know, that happens some, but it's so rare. And hence why you need people to have good training around autism specific. You know, there is a, I have it right here. There is, I think it's, of all the adults with autism who live in a residential placement, so outside the home of their parents, only 1% of them live in a home where the people working in the home have had training on autism specifically. 1%. That's crazy. And so, you know, if people don't understand autism, then they're going to make their own assumptions. But I think it's important to know that that's more of an individual service provider. But the more people you have in your home, you open yourself up to that. But the good thing, Medicaid, Medicare knows who the guardian is. They are not going to mess with that. They're there to provide services to the individual. And so I would say parents should not fear working with Medicaid and Medicare, because I do tons of cases and I do tons of hearings and I testify, and we do not see Medicaid and Medicare coming into the family unit and causing problems. That's not their job. Their job is to fund services that individual has been recommended and they need. So the parents should not fear that, and they should embrace it, and they are part of the team. So I think that's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have not found that to be the case with my own son, and the waiver that he's on, he has the IO as well. And, you know, I have not had any indications of a loss of control at all.
Right, right. Even if you get a treatment recommendation from a professional that you're not comfortable with, then you need to go get another treatment recommendation. So it's still, you know, Medicaid and Medicare are going to fund treatment recommendations that you as a family and the professional and everybody believe is right for the child. So, you know, so, yeah, I would not fear, you know, using that public funding in that manner, and millions of people are doing it, so.
And it is certainly still the parents' right to deny any, you know, recommendations that they feel aren't right. You know, they can go elsewhere and seek second and third and fourth opinions.
Yes. Now, I will tell you that there is a Medicaid funding source called 4E funding, and it's the Roman numeral 4, the letter E funding. This funding is used when an individual would go into have to go live somewhere other than their family, and maybe their family and state agencies cannot pool enough money together to support that individual. When that happens, and it, you know, as long as the parent feels like this residential treatment or whatever the treatment is away from their home is appropriate, they can then give up custody to access these 4E dollars to support what the individual needs. But that is a lengthy process, and that's not something that happens quickly. So that's the good thing about that. But that would be a time maybe a parent, you know, but would lose the guardianship. But I can tell you, those parents are at the table at every discussion, and they have the right to be there. They are always a team member, even if guardianship has been given up to access the 4E funding. So I would say that, just in case the parent in San Diego is driving and is more in that area.
Okay. I do have several people asking a similar question, and it is about the problem with getting funding is that we make too much money.
Okay, good question. One of the things I want people to know is that Medicaid, we all know that there are income level caps under Medicaid, but there's also types of Medicaid. In Ohio, the type of Medicaid I'm speaking about is called Age, Blind, and Disabled Medicaid. This is where somebody has been diagnosed with one of those and needs services. Now, it's a way to, it kind of waives the family income, but there's what they call a spend down or a copayment. So the family would have to pay a certain amount of dollars up front, and then once that's done, then they would have access to Medicaid for the rest of the month. So in Ohio, that's called Age, Blind, and Disabled Medicaid. So I would think in any state, if you asked for, hey, my family member has a disability, I'm pretty sure there are Medicaid programs for people with disability that I may have to pay a little each month, but then I would get access to the Medicaid program from there forward. And so what you need to know about the program is there is still a resource limit. You can only have so much liquid cash available, even though they're going to waive your income. But then the higher your income, the higher the spend down or copayment is there. But as many of us families know and professionals know, you know, our families spend a lot of money on treatment already. Many families who cannot take their child to a normal daycare because they can't meet that child level of care, they may pay somebody special, and so maybe they're paying more like $10 an hour than what they would at a daycare. You know, those expenditures around the treatment and the medical needs of the child, those things can add up. So if you determine that your family is already spending $300 to $500 a month, that's a part of that copayment or the spend down I'm talking about. So if you go to your state Medicaid division and you ask for disability Medicaid program and that you feel that you may qualify, you may already meet your spend down or copayment needs on things you're already purchasing. You know, all your copayments, all your physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, maybe you're purchasing behavioral health care, having a behavioral consultant come in your home, all those expenditures would add up towards the copayment or spend down, and all medical expenditures for the entire household. So if your typical child goes to the doctor for the flu and you pay a $20 copayment, that $20 is going to go towards that spend down as well. So it's a great question. So look for disability Medicaid. You will have to have a disability determination either through Social Security or the Medicaid division in your state. But that's not a hard process, especially if you have a good psychological assessment to take into them. So I would definitely check that out, because there's many families that get turned down just because of level of income, and they don't even look at the person with the disabilities information.
Good information. Lynn from Valley Cottage asks, due to funding cuts in the state of New York, unless you are a single parent or Medicaid eligible, the state won't even look at your application for the waiver program or home and community-based waiver program. What can a parent do to change this, and what options are there for those of us who are not Medicaid eligible or single parents?
Ooh, this is a fantastic question, because what I think I heard you say, Nancy, is she's being turned down for a waiver because she doesn't, because she's over income.
Yeah, she's not Medicaid eligible and she's not a single parent.
Okay, So we got all kinds of fun things we could talk about here. Well, that's a great question. A child is Medicaid eligible as soon as the child gets a diagnosis and has a disability determination. So my son has autism. My son is greatly impacted by the diagnosis and has intensive needs. And somebody is going to do a simple assessment at that time through some kind of government entity. Here in Ohio, it's the Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities. And they say, yes, your child is greatly impacted by his disability and will continue to be. And so he does meet our level of care. Now, he may be put on the wait list at that time, but you are Medicaid eligible as soon as you have a diagnosis and you're greatly, you know, you're going to be impacted more than 12 months because of that diagnosis, and that's pretty much what a disability determination is. So a child with autism, unless they're extremely high functioning, is going to be a Medicaid eligible minor. And so that's always fascinating to tell the State Department that, no, I already know my child's a Medicaid eligible consumer. It's whether or not I meet your income regulations. Now, Medicaid waivers should, remember, waive the family's income. So when I go and I ask whatever division in my state here in Ohio, the Developmental Disabilities, I'd like to get on the wait list for a Medicaid waiver, they need to put me on the wait list for a Medicaid waiver. So I'm on the wait list. Once my number comes up on that wait list, then they're going to assess my child for that waiver. Medicaid waivers do not look at the family income. So the parent in New York should not be being told that she has the right to be on the Medicaid waiver wait list. And when her number comes up, her child will be assessed for level of care. And then if he meets that level of care for that waiver, he should be given that waiver if it's his time and his number's up. So I agree, there's been budget cuts and there's been long wait lists. Now, unless there's a new waiver out there that looks at family income, and maybe New York does, there's just so many changes going on very rapidly. But normally, that's what happens. You hear people say remember, there's Medicaid waivers, the set plan of services, and there's Medicaid card or Medicaid medical plans, right? The fee for service where you get the Medicaid card to purchase services. Those Medicaid card services, yes, the family can be over income, but Medicaid waiver, you should not be over income. So maybe go back and ask those questions again, or maybe even email me and I can take a look at it. In our state, whether we have a specific form in our state of Ohio to put our name on the waiver wait list, and we can do that. So that may be something you could ask some people in the community there. Is there a specific form I can fill out to get on the Medicaid waiver wait list? Because you really need to get on that Medicaid waiver wait list, because those wait lists are based on the date you entered the wait list. And so one other thing to let you know, unfortunately, is people that are working in these Medicaid divisions where, you know, the people that input your information, the computers, they are not well trained. Because of budget cuts, they have very large workloads, and so they may not be hearing you saying, I have a child with a disability, I'm here for a Medicaid waiver, which shouldn't look at my income. So that's, using the good terminology, unfortunately, can be helpful. So I think I would look into that again. If you're still struggling, email me through my through the stepbystepacademy.org website, and let's see if we can't, you know, pull in a national advocacy group to help us with that.
Okay. I've had several people ask how to access services when they actually live in a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may be eligible to receive PTOT and ABA therapy, but there's no providers in their area. Is that when
yes.
that comes in, that the services should be created?
Yes. It should be. Now, one of the things we know about Medicaid is Medicaid has to be statewide. Okay, and you freedom of choice a provider with Medicaid. So if you go to one Medicaid provider and for some reason the state's saying, no, you have to go to this one, that they can't do that. There's freedom of choice a provider, and Medicaid needs to be statewide. Now, Medicaid is statewide, but the problem is there's no service providers in that area. And that is a huge, huge problem. It's a huge problem in Ohio, and it's a huge problem everywhere. How do you get these proper treatments in smaller towns and so forth? Well, it's not easy. I remember when I lived in Arizona, I wanted to go to a certain medical doctor because my son had intestinal issues, and I had to drive. It was like an hour and a half to get to him. He was a professional. Autism was within the scope of practice. But, you know, for things like, you know, speech therapy, occupational therapy, you know, it's sad when we don't have these type of therapies in our communities, and especially when around autism, you know, behavioral intervention services. So one of the things you could do is, A, work with your school district. Try to get those services inside school when the child is there. If it's an adult, what kind of adult program are they in? Maybe work with like your Autism Society chapters in your area, somebody to say, how do we get these services in this area? How do we attract these professionals we need? You know, I know some in Ohio, the Southeast region is really struggling for proper services. And so we're trying to work with the university down there to say, you know, how can we bring some professionals down here? How can you support us? Because it's a huge area of need in our state. So in being vocal to your state, but it's very tough. One of the things you could do is through maybe a local advocacy group is find out what other parents are in the same boat you are. And then, you know, and then how do you take that data and try to attract some professionals there? Maybe go meet with some service providers in Columbus. So I can tell you one of the things step-by-step's doing, and this is totally down this line, is we're stepping out. So we have some classroom programs in Mount Gilead in Cardington, Ohio, which is, I think, about 45 an hour outside Columbus, at least, probably even an hour and 20 minutes outside of Columbus, because they just had no behavioral intervention out there. We teamed up with the school district to bring it to that area. You know, we're trying to get some things in Southeast Ohio. So look for big service providers and just start having conversations. How can we get your services down here? What can we do? Maybe look at your developmental board, your local government, let them know there's a need. And, you know, these needs are called accessibility needs. You know, my child cannot access a service he needs, and that has now become an accessibility issue. Somebody needs to help, you know, get my son these treatments. But we know this is a problem. And what we know is our Medicaid rates, at least in Ohio, the farther out you go, those service providers are paid a little more money because of the travel and some things that go on. So there are zones, at least in Ohio, to help and provide some incentive to get services out in that area. So I'd look at your schools. I'd look, you know, what services providers are in the area and how could you build that service in your area. And that's a lot for a parent to take on, isn't it? That's a lot. So I think that's why you want to bring your advocacy groups in to help.
There are folks that are submitting questions from places like Botswana and Nigeria. They're also saying that there's just a lack of services. Would you suggest that they get connected to their local advocacy groups? Because they're all over the world.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, they need to do that, but I think they also need to start talking to their legislators and whoever they have that they can talk to and talk about these accessibility issues. We can't get services here. You know, are you aware of how many children are diagnosed with autism in, you know, in our country, in our area? Because, you know, that's huge. And you know, especially if you can get somebody like that on your side and who says, yes, you're right, you know, A, it creates jobs, right, because somebody's going to provide the service. And then, you know, how do we work out that funding and bring the services there? So I think a lot of advocating is needed around that, unfortunately. But, you know, try to find a professional, maybe a professional that treats people with autism. Say, hey, can you help me go to these legislators and talk about the need we have and how do we get that created here? Because it's very sad that we have people who can't access, you know, the proper treatments they need.
Mm-hmm. Is there a website or something that lists ABA specialists or providers for the United States or for everywhere that you know of?
Yeah, I know a couple. I know our executive director at Step by Step, Michelle LaMarche, has a company called Special Learning. And the Special Learning website is, I'm going to find it here, is really fantastic in listing people who are like board certified behavior analysts, who work with the behavior analyst field. They have a lot of they're building databases like crazy, and it's so cool because it allows you to, you know, access, you know, services in your area. So I'm pulling them up right here. So their website is www.special-learning.com. And so again, www.special-learning.com. And they have some good directories on, you know, they're very behavior analysis based, where we're looking at intensive behavioral interventions, and they have great resources there on how to find services there. So I think that'd be a good place. The other good place is, do you have a behavior analysis board in your area? Like we have the Ohio Association of Behavior Analysis. See if you have a behavior analysis board in your state or your region, and see who they can link you to in regards to, you know, behavioral interventions. You could always call, like I don't know what the official name of that is, but like the American Society of Speech Therapists. I mean, think about these organizations. Even if you live outside of the United States, if you call the American Association for Speech Therapy, I'm sure they're going to support you and help you get contacts in your country and where you live. So, you know, I would, you know, use those groups. Talking to other people in your community, how to access services. Would be important as well. I know the Autism Society of America, they have a database of providers and services and how to find them. So that's kind of cool. The one great thing about the internet, it's really amazing to help families, you know, find things. I don't know how in the world, you know, families have done it in the past without the internet because, you know, we all learned so much through that. Just go on and Google it. You could Google speech therapy in my area, behavioral, you know, analyst in my area. But service providers, that's not so easy.
And then if they just don't exist in your area, fight to get them there.
Mm-hmm. Make a team, get a coalition going, and you know, try to attract them to your area. Mm-hmm. There's a need here. You know, sometimes that's all a service provider needs to expand is, hey, we have a need down here. Well, what's your need? Well, you know, I'm working with 20 families right here who are looking for a service. Oh, that's a big need. So sometimes it's just reaching out to people and just say, hey, would you take 5 minutes to talk to me about this and try to develop them in your area? Mm-hmm. That, and I'll tell you, that's how we got started up in many. We just went into another rural place here in Ohio. I mean, that's the way you do that, by, you know, reaching out and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how the insurance reform is going to be affecting coverage for OT speech, PT, ABA?
Well, hopefully what's going to happen in this autism insurance reform is that they no longer can say that because your child has autism, they're not speaking, and because it's autism, we're not going to pay for it, right? We're really looking to, and we literally have had people denied in the emergency room when their child fell down and broke their arm, and insurance denied it because they carried the autism diagnosis. So, we're very hopeful that, and you know, we're looking for autism treatments and medical treatments. And so, you know, hopefully states are building their legislation, you know, not only are they including behavioral interventions, but they're including, you know, any service that a professional needs to be treated to be available and accessible to the individual. I'm processing what Ohio says right now, and I can't remember at the moment. But I mean, the whole point is for, you know, for them to be able to get treatments. And so that, so you'd want to look at what is your state's legislation and what does it say about it? And you know, if you're not seeing those things in there, then advocate with whoever is, you know, putting the bill forth in the legislation to how do we get these pieces added?
Okay. I want to remind our callers that if you'd like to ask a question directly to Marla, just press star 2, and it will alert me that you have your hand raised. I had a question from Nikki in Ohio. She asks, our number is up for the waiver. Congratulations. And my son has a $1,000 bond. Should we cash it in?
I would say no, because we know that it's $1,500 is this asset limit. So you should be fine. So when you go in for your waiver, they're going to do a financial assessment on your child, and you're going to say, hey, we have a $1,000, you know, bond. Now, what will happen is that bond, even if it was $2,000, the bond is not going to stop him from getting the waiver. He's just not going to be able to access the waiver services until that bond is under the $1,500. So if that's what he has in his name, and that's all he has in his name at $1,000, he should be fine, and he should be able to receive that waiver with no problem.
And this is a whole nother topic, but does that include, like, life insurance policies for the child, you know, funding for after you're gone?
Mm-hmm. Well, you do have to watch that. I mean, you know, if you want to put money in your child's name, you really need to be putting it into either a special needs trust, or if you are trying to save for, you know, a college, that, you know, it's in an appropriate plan that protects it. So, you know, anything over $1,500 is going to have to be in some kind of vehicle that Medicaid approves. And I know a little bit about that, and I know in Ohio right now, actually, hey, I think we're having, if you go to stepbystepacademy.org, we're going to have a presentation coming up just on these topics in the next month, I think. And there are several organizations. I know Prudential Securities, especially in Ohio and especially in regions around Ohio, are really developing a service to help parents with these topics. So that'd be somebody you could look for. But I'm pretty sure if you go to our website, if you're close, or at least we could get you the information that's talked about that day. But yeah, you do have to watch the vehicle the money's being put in, and something that qualifies as like a special needs trust or educational, you know, college savings. Those are okay. But you just kind of got to watch. I think life insurance may be a problem, but I'm not sure about that. And it depends on the value of the life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it shouldn't stop you from getting the waiver. It'll stop you accessing it until you get under their resource limit of $1,500.
Okay. Debbie from Pensacola just has submitted a little help for us here about trying to find a behavior analyst website. She says that if you go to www.bacb.com, the Behavior Analyst Certification Board, that all certified behavior analysts are listed there, and you can type in your zip code and get all local BCBAs and BCABAs. So So
She is totally accurate. I can't believe I forgot that website, so I'm glad she chimed in. So that is accurate. That's where you go to find when people do get certified with those credentials for behavior analysis. That's where you would find them. So she, thank you for reminding us of that. That was perfect.
Thank you, Debbie.
Yeah.
I know that this question is going to be, I know how you're going to answer this, so let me ask it. G. Morris from New York City asks, are the waivers available in all states, and if so, what's the maximum income to qualify?
Okay. It's my understanding that Medicaid waivers are available in all states, and they all should, again, waive the family's income level. So if the individual is a minor, it's going to waive that family's income level. So should be accessible in all states. They're all going to be called different and have different services and names of services, but they should be accessible, and income should not be impacted to the individual getting that waiver.
Does adoption funds or adoption, you know, payments, do those affect the waiver eligibility? Do you know?
They would not affect waiver eligibility. So, it's funny because depending on the case, I've had some families be able to keep the Medicaid when the child's adopted, but some families not. But I think that's more around Medicaid card services outside of a waiver, where those income guidelines would then be, once the child's adopted, then the family income is looked at, and if the family income is over Medicaid eligibility, they would not qualify for Medicaid. But if an adopted child gets the Medicaid waiver, and actually I can think of several families now that have adopted children, you know, once they get that Medicaid waiver, remember the waiver does not look at the family's income, then that waiver would be that child's. So, I don't know a lot about how long adopted child gets to keep Medicaid and so forth, but they have the same right to a Medicaid waiver as any other child with a disability does.
And it doesn't matter at what age your child is diagnosed. The steps are still the same, right?
Well,
except
that's
it may skip the 0 to 3 thing if it's
right.
Child older.
Yeah, usually Medicaid waivers are usually you become eligible for a Medicaid waiver at age 3. That's not always true, but somewhat close to that. It shouldn't matter the age. Now, what people really need to know about Medicaid waivers, and we just talk about it a lot, but you know, there are lengthy wait lists. I know in the state of Ohio last fall, because I actually haven't called to get the new numbers, there were like, let me see, I have it right here. Let me find this for you because, you know, I have to believe that, you know, we're similar to other states. But one of the things we have a problem with here in Ohio is we have a lot of aging caregivers that have their loved ones still in their home. And, you know, we're talking aging caregivers getting into their 60s and 70s and because they're on a wait list. And so this is a huge problem. So I can tell you that in the fall of 2010, we had about 26,000 people enrolled onto a Medicaid waiver for people that had disabilities. But we had, we have about 37,000 people. That's a little much. We have about 30,000 people waiting for a Medicaid waiver in our state. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of people waiting. So, those are kind of some of those issues. Now, the other thing too to talk to you guys about is you know, we understand that we're on waiting list to get the waiver. Now, in Ohio, the way it works here, if you're number 200 on the waiver wait list, but your need has become an emergency status. An emergency status means that something is going on with the individual that if they don't get help soon, they are going to harm themselves or harm others. And so what happens is an individual could be deemed emergency status because they've lost their caregiver, and it's just them. They've lost their residence. There's been some kind of abuse or neglect that has happened to them. There's major health and safety risks that we talked about, or there's some kind of change of emotional and physical condition of the individual that is very hard to accommodate. So it's very hard to get an emergency status waiver and move up those waiver waiting lists. Not easy. People with autism tend to do it a little bit more, especially those greatly impacted who may have, you know, intensive, aggressive, maybe self-interest behaviors. So if you're uncomfortable where you are on a waiver wait list, you do have a right to appeal and ask somebody to relook at your case. So just know that you do have appeal rights if you're uncomfortable where you are on the waiver wait list.
Okay. Let's see. We had a question here about Social Security. Do you know what funding is available through Social Security by chance, and does it vary?
Well, I'm not really good with Social Security. But what I do know, I mean, I know that Social Security, the amount you receive, especially when the individual is still living at home with parents or whatever, that amount is different based on the income level of the household. And that when you get Social Security income for a person with disability, it's to be used to support the living environment of that individual, but also can be used for treatment. So I don't know a lot about Social Security, but one thing I do know is that when you go to them, the first thing they're going to do is a disability determination. They're going to look at some kind of psychological assessment from you a professional says that your child has autism. And then the next thing they're going to look at it is what degree of impact does the autism have on your daily life? Are you going to be impacted for more than 12 months? And if yes, you would be deemed disabled. So you may be a family over income, but you may get a response back from Social Security that says, yes, your child has been deemed disabled, but you're over the income to get funding. So I don't know a lot, but I can tell you they have what they call their Red Book. And let me look this up for you. The Red Book is a fantastic resource, and it's kind of a handbook for Social Security. It makes it just a little easier for us parents to read. The Red Book, let me type in Social Security here.
Does that change when the individual is deemed an adult, do you think? Do they look at the individual's income then instead of the parents?
Yeah, but because they get $674 as adults.
Uh-huh.
I think they get the full amount once they become 18. I think they do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here is what I would suggest going to. It is www.ssa.gov, and then I would just type in Red Book. I also just went to Google and said Red Book Social Security, and it pulled me up there as well. This is a summary kind of guide that I think is extremely helpful. It just how to reach Social Security. What you really are looking for is the overview of our disability programs. It talks about comparison between programs. How do you qualify? I have found in the past it's a little easier to use this. Special rules for persons who are blind, additional help with health care for persons with disabilities. So this is a great website for people to start with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. One thing, though, you're talking about these, a lot of these questions, you know, how do I keep my loved one eligible for Medicaid and waiver services? Because these services are huge in these individuals' lives. Those are where you, if you can find a free seminar about this, I would go. One thing, and at least here in Ohio, and I'm sure all across the nation they do these, but school districts will pull together and do what they call transition nights. And transition nights are a way for parents to come find people who serve people with disabilities once they exit out of education. So you could find adult day programs, but almost always there's somebody there who knows how to plan for your loved one and how to keep them Medicaid eligible. And Social Security is always a part of it. So I think transition nights inside your high school is a good idea. The other thing to remember is, remember, when our kids turn 16, they should have a transition plan in their IEP with their school district. And one of the part of that transition plan you could actually probably put on your child's IEP is, can I use a school counselor or somebody to help me get some general knowledge around Social Security, because my child's going to start receiving it, and, you know, how do we use it? And, you know, you could ask for them, for their support from them. So the other thing is, there's lots of Social Security offices around. They're more regional, I think, now, but you could go there and try to get an appointment. But I think if you, you know, look at the Red Book and look at those certain sections around disabilities and just get a little familiar. But boy, if you could find a free seminar in your area, I think that would be huge. And I bet your school, or through their transition special ed director, they probably know when those things are going on. They can help direct you. Because we just had one in Ohio this week, and I got a text from a person who puts on these financial seminars, and sure enough, she was there. She had a booth at the transition night. So I think that would be a good way to get help there. I'm hoping to learn. Actually, Nancy, it's one of the things maybe we can do a webinar on soon, because I really would like to learn more. Or I just met a woman named Marla, actually, in the Social Security Administration. Maybe we can get her to come on, because I think that's a desperate need for parents to understand that.
Absolutely. Just trying to get a handle on the, you know, school stuff, and before I know it, he's going to be an adult, so.
Yes.
I'm not prepared.
Yeah. Things.
It's a whole new ball game.
Yes, it is. It really is. I am still trying to look up these state-of-the-art testing tools, because I had worked on this. Let me see if I just found it.
Well, this kind of falls in line with what we're talking about. Angie from Fullerton asks, when my son turns 18 and is unable to make the choices for himself, how do I retain a voice?
You know, that I haven't worked on a lot of cases about that, but that is when our individuals with autism are, you know, have really good abilities and are not greatly impacted by the diagnosis, that is very tough. I know I just worked with a family who really, the individual really wants to drive, and they're trying to figure out how to do that. So you're right. I mean, you know, if... especially because if they haven't been deemed disabled, right? So that would probably, let's talk about that for a minute, because I think that could be huge. So remember we talked about the psychological assessment, the educational assessment, and how it has to paint a very clear picture of the individual. Sometimes individuals with I'm going to say higher functioning because I can't think of the word right now, with autism, struggle accessing services because they're not impacted enough by the disability. But if we really look at a good comparison, what are typical individuals doing at that age and what is your loved one doing at that age, that's where you have to draw the comparison. And you've got to start with health and safety. Are there health and safety risks that my child has because of the autism diagnosis that puts him at a greater risk than somebody with a typical functioning level at the same age? That could be a way to start. So if you have concern that
your loved one is doesn't understand. I can tell you a case that I had recently. The individual did not understand that selling drugs was wrong because he saw other people doing it, making money, and he thought that was a job. Okay? He did not have the cognitive ability to understand, okay, you're breaking the law. Yeah, you're making money, and it looks like a job, but that's breaking the law. So you've got to look up about, you know, and obviously that posed a large health and safety risk. You know, he can be busted and go to jail, but it can put him in very dangerous situations. Maybe somebody would have a gun, somebody would have a knife, and he can't understand the social impact of what's going on his decisions. So sometimes individuals, you know, and families struggle with this, but if you really look at, you have to look very hard, and you need a good psychologist, maybe a good counselor, somebody who can maybe go to bat with you. So, yes, my child does have autism. Yes, he's not greatly impacted, but if you understand how he is impacted and the risk that this poses for him, then you would understand our concerns that we need to stay his guardian. He's not going to make good decisions, and it's going to pose a health and safety risk for him. That would be my suggestion for families to look at doing something like that first. Mm-hmm. And maybe get some counselors, you know, those parents maybe could get counseling from here in Ohio, our Ohio Department of Developmental Disabilities, they have adult services. So maybe go in and talk to some of those people in those adult services and say, okay, you know, we're getting concerned about, we think he's just going to go and get in trouble or not know how to handle things, and how do we retain guardianship? And I can tell you, in Ohio, what is that called? I just got a pamphlet that talks about guardianship and when to retain it. I think it's the Developmental Disability Council of Ohio. Let me just see real quick if I'm telling you correctly. But, you know, I have to believe disability determination, guardianship rules are very equal through state to state. So the Ohio Developmental Disabilities Council is what that is. I'll tell you another place to go look for these kind of things is in Ohio. We have the Ohio Legal Rights Service. So it's a place that what do they do? They stick up for the rights of people with disability. Every state has one. Mine in Ohio is called Ohio Legal Rights Service. They are fantastic. These are attorneys, extremely knowledgeable on Medicaid rules, guardianship, you name it, anything dealing with a person with disability. They are a fantastic resource for families. I would assume they're all called like legal rights services, but they always have fantastic resources on their website, so check them out. So look for a guardianship pamphlet in your state. And I think maybe you could probably get that through your legal rights, because I think you could probably get some help there as well.
Very nice.
I just found a little bit of information on the clinical testing.
Okay.
And I'm trying to find, let me see if I have, I have a good start here. I was hoping I had a little bit more here. I'm just looking. I think it's a good start for us, and we can always, I know somebody could do a webinar for you on that, so we could do that. Okay, so one of the things you could do that are pretty common with intellectual tests for people with autism is the Stanford-Binet, which is B-I-N-E-T. So that's a common intellectual test that would be done for an individual with autism. Another thing that a psychologist would do would be a clinical interview or a mental status exam. I'm not really sure. I don't think there's structured tools around doing that, but there may be around the mental status exam. You could probably Google that, but it's just a good history of the individual, what have they been through,
but it's not a super formal testing tool. For behavioral rating measures, I would use, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, the BASC-2. It's BASC-2, and I'm going to tell you what that stands for, BASC-2. And let me pull this up. I should know this, and I can't remember. It is the Behavioral Assessment System for Children, and it's pulling up here. I can only see. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so it is the Behavioral Assessment System for Children, and that's the BASC-2. And you can Google that, and that'll bring that up. Another one for adaptive functioning is the Vineland 2. So adaptive functioning, Vineland 2. And that is a very common assessment tool. You know, one of the things we talk about a lot is sometimes us parents, we say, oh, yes, my child can do that. But sometimes we don't realize, especially when our children are little, and I'm guilty of this as well, we don't realize how much we're doing for our kids to make our kids be successful because we've always had to do it. And so one of the questions I was asked once during an assessment for my son, which really got me thinking, was, and my son had some problem behavior, probably about the age of 10 at the time, and they asked me, how much do you manipulate his schedule, the environment, and things that are going on around him to keep problem aggressive behavior down, or the frequency? I said, oh, my word, I'm doing that all the time. So, you know, if I would have, you know, take some of those controls I had away, he'd have higher. So it was just a kind of fascinating thing to look at. Diagnostic test for autism. Here they are, and they're acronyms, so I'm sorry to say. The ADIR, again, the ADIR, the ADOS, which is ADOS, ADOS, and the SCQ, SCQ. Those are three different testing specific to autism. We hear a lot of talk around the ADOS. I misspelled it so it didn't pull up. I'm trying to give you good. You hear the word ADOS used a lot. So ADOS stands for Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. And I'll tell you, another tool that is huge that really shows where your child is and will graph it is the ABLES. And the ABLES is something any clinician, school district, if they're working with your child, they need to be doing an ABLES. An ABLES is an assessment of basic language and learning skills. Now, some higher functioning kids, it may not benefit more. But for kids, especially kids that have splinter skills and things like this, the ABLES, which is called the Assessment of Basic Language and Learning Skills, can be huge. And there's one other thing I want to bring up, because especially with individuals who are less impacted, is executive functioning skills. Executive functioning skills are what we use to help us stay organized, be able to take information in and organize it. And so executive functioning skills can be an area where our kids struggle. And so that's a good one for families to know. Executive functioning skills can be as simple as my son does very well in a typical classroom, but they have this 15 minutes where they have to be quiet and read, and he has a hard time doing that. Well, we decided as an executive functioning skill to put a timer on his desk, and it he can watch the timer, and he can watch the 15 minutes go by. As long as he can see it, that'll help him keep on on task where it says reading. So executive functioning skill testing should definitely be done. And executive functioning skill can be huge for ADD, ADHD, and things like that. So remember, I'm not a clinical person, but I can tell you that I've had some specific speaking with testing materials with a psychologist at our center at Step by Step. So everybody, feel free to visit, you know, our website. We have a place where you can ask for general information. Again, part of our mission and organization is always to be helpful. If we don't know it, try to get you linked where you can. If you go on that website and email me, I kind of have, it's somewhat of an Ohio specific, but I have a lot of internet links. But I think, you know, those internet links you could use to learn to find those areas in your state. So if you email me through the website and just say, hey, you know, can I get your links, I can email you back with some links. So that's all I have on the testing materials, Nancy.
Well, that's a great list. I mean, I now have my work cut out for me.
Yeah, we thought of a couple more webinars, haven't we?
Yes, we do. Yes, we have, and I've got some testing to do, so...
Mm-hmm.
And I told you, Marla, the 2 hours would fly.
Yeah, wow.
And they have. And I'm afraid that we're out of time tonight. And there's still so much more to talk about. But if anyone has a question they'd like to ask, go to stepbystepacademy.org and look for Marla and contact her. She will be more than happy to respond. And she's a great advocate, and her office has helped me a lot, too. Personally. So I want to thank you for being with us tonight and for sharing all that wonderful information about the waivers and funding and assessments and everything.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I really enjoyed it. And thanks, everybody, for chiming in and asking great questions. And that's fantastic. This was an awesome experience.
Well, we're going to do it again soon.
Good.
I'm going to get with you on your calendar.
Good. Let's do it.
I want to let everyone know that they should pencil me in for November 2nd, where we will have Dr. Jim Ball. Dr. Jim is a board-certified behavior analyst. A board-certified behavior analyst. He's been working in the private sector field of autism for 25-plus years, and he's always very entertaining and very informative, so we're going to have a great time with Dr. Jim. And if you want a transcript of this webinar tonight, join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking on the Gold Club button on the screen, and you will be sent a copy of this webinar audio and transcript, plus 29 other webinars when you join.